You know what? I couldn't even remember what the homework was. It was just, wasn't it just to read Romans 7 and 8? And kind of start studying that? You should have read Romans 7 and 8 anyway, Dave. So what I want to do tonight is just kind of give an overview of Buddhism. And the way I'm going to do that is through what's called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And as we look at that, that's just kind of the way that Buddhism has developed over time. And then next week, what we'll do is we'll look at I think next week we will probably wrap up Buddhism. And kind of what I got planned for the rest of the class is, next week hopefully we'll wrap up Buddhism. Then after that, we'll do a couple of weeks of Judaism. And then we'll do Islam, which is probably going to be huge. And then I'm going to end with Jehovah's Witnesses. Unless anybody has any other thing that they would like to study, and I thought about maybe putting Catholicism in there, but I do want to end with Jehovah's Witnesses just because I think, I don't know about you, but I get them to my door fairly regularly. And I think it's important to understand what they do believe and have some answers so that when they come to you with, you know, their literature and their different ideas about things, that we have answers to what they say to us. So. Really. And they're so convincing, and they're so close. You know, they talk about Jesus. They have the Bible. They talk about all these things. But, you know, it's the doctrines that they change and leave out that are deadly. So that's my plan. I'm going to end with that and probably spend quite a bit of time on Jehovah's Witnesses. So, and like I say, unless anybody else has something that they would like to cover, I'm totally open to that too. But that's the plan right now. So tonight, like I say, what I want to do is just kind of give an overview of Buddhism, and then next week we'll look at some ethical things in Buddhism, and then compare that to Christianity and some of the teachings of Christianity, and compare that to what the Buddhists believe about it. So tonight, we're going to look at what are called the three turnings. And the first turning, we already looked at, it'll be kind of a review, was just the orthodox teaching of Buddhism. It's represented today by Theravada, or the Way of the Elders. The second and the third turning, arise out of what's called Mahayana Buddhism, and we also looked at that a little bit. We'll kind of do a little review over that too. The second turning is represented by what's called the Madhyamaka school, and the third turning is called Yogacara. And both of those last two are just, they have a few little different discrepancies over some minor issues, but they both arise out of the Mahayana school. So the first turning, and we'll just do some review here over Theravada. If you remember, after Buddha's death, and some people say a couple of months, some people say hundreds of years, but after Buddha's death, his disciples held three councils. And these councils were concerning the Dharma, which is the Buddha's teaching. And that teaching, the main things that they were trying to iron out were the nature of the Buddha himself, and then the nature of the community, the Sangha, the body of believers. And what was the role of the laity, what was the role of the monks. You know, they were trying to iron out these kinds of issues, and then also the nature of the Buddha himself. So out of that, those councils came essentially a few different things. First of all, were the original teachings of the Buddha. And those were in what were known as the three baskets, or the Tripitaka. And it's called the Pali Canon. And Pali was just the language that those were written in. So those original teachings came out in the three baskets, and then that also included some commentaries and things like that that some of the different disciples had written on the teachings. The second thing that kind of summarized the Buddha's teaching were known as the Four Noble Truths, which were suffering is universal, the cause of suffering is desire, there is a way to stop the desire, and then the way is the Eightfold Path. So then the Eightfold Path was basically the right view, which is understanding the Dharma or the teaching of the Buddha. Then right intention, which is the willingness to achieve enlightenment, the willingness to search out and to understand the Dharma. Then right speech, which kind of went along with the middle way that Buddha had introduced, which is you say all that's necessary, but say no more. There's no embellishment, there's no profanity, there's no a lying, gossip, things like that. You say what is necessary, but you say no more. The fourth of the Eightfold Path was right action. And that kind of went along with the middle way too. You do what is necessary, but no more. That would include things like no sexual misconduct, no alcohol abuse, substance abuse, things like that, no cheating, things like that. The right action. Do what is necessary, but no more. Then there was right livelihood, and originally this was the only right livelihood was to become a monk. And eventually that expanded to include that your vocation, whatever it was that you did for a living, you were just to do that in line with these first four precepts. So if you ran your business, you did it honestly, you know, you did it, you know, without cheating, without lying, you know, things like that. So it expanded to kind of include more than just the monks. And then the last three kind of have more to do with meditation. And those were right effort, and that is just directing your energies properly, following the Dharma, things like that. And then there was right mindfulness, which is proper meditation. And then finally there was right concentration, which basically is just maintaining a concentration during your meditation and maintaining your focus and maintaining focus on the here and now. And this is basically just a right form of meditation. So these are the original teachings of the Buddha. This is what eventually became known as the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And today, the only representation of any of that is in Theravada Buddhism, or the way of the elders. So are there any questions, comments about that? Most of that was just review. Okay, so during the Second Council, there was a split that occurred. And out of that split arose a lay movement. And that lay movement was known as the Mahasanghika, or the Great Community, which that eventually emerged into what we know as Mahayana Buddhism. And
which is that
crown
preeminent today?
Mahayana? Yeah, Mahayana Buddhism today is basically over 80% of all Buddhism. It's kind of an umbrella term because that's what we're going to look at tonight. There are a couple of different philosophies under that umbrella of Mahayana, but things like Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism.
Do they have any touchstones or mile markers that they can point to or go back to determine faithfulness to it or impartial from it?
To their teaching?
Yeah.
No. And that's one of the problems because... And that's what we're going to look at here in a minute, but let's see. Well, we're going to talk about that right now. So I think I can answer your question with what we're going to look at right here in a minute. Timothy Tennant in his book, Christianity at the Religious Roundtable, and if I don't answer it, just, you know, ask again, but Timothy Tennant, in his book, Christianity, the Religious Roundtable, says, justification for new developments in Buddhist thought is made by asserting that the early core teaching of Buddha represents only the more elementary aspects of the Buddha's full teaching. Mahayana claims Buddha secretly gave additional, more profound teaching to his intimate disciples, only now fully coming to light through the preaching of Mahayana. So the justification given for this split in the community, in the Sangha, is that the more initiated, the more intimate with the Buddha himself, you know, the Buddha's disciples are bringing to light this new, this additional, this more profound information, and that, you know, he revealed that just to his intimate followers, and that it's more, it included more than just the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, and things like that. And the thing is, now that Mahayana has, you know, developed and split off this original teaching, this is exactly what you're talking about, Lee. Now the canon is completely open. And it's like I was saying, I think it was the last time, you may go into some Buddhist temples, and there may be thousands of different scriptures there that different Buddhas or monks or whatever have written, and they are, to one extent or another, authoritative. Because all of this teaching comes from introspection, inside, meditation, things like that. So, no, they don't really have anything to say that, you know, you're that's not authoritative.
It would, for example, necessarily reject the Bible. I mean, if you said, I believe the Bible, I understand that they would say, that's fine, if that works for you.
Absolutely. Because they would view Christ as a Buddha. Because he would fulfill some of the things that they even teach that a Buddha would be able to do. For instance, walk on water, walk through walls, read people's minds, things like that. The only problem that a Buddhist would have with you and your Bible is when you say this is the only way. They don't care. You can use Zen, you can use their meditation practices and things like that to help understand your Bible, to have a deeper understanding with your God. They don't have a problem with that at all. You know, they already have, you know, maybe thousands of these bodhisattvas and different Buddhas and things like that. One more is not going to matter. But when you try to tell them that's the only way, then they have a problem with it. Same way with Hinduism. You can be a Hindu, you can be a Christian Hindu, a Hindu Christian or whatever, but when you try to tell them that Christ is the only way, that's where the problem starts. So we already had this split. So we had this split in the Sangha during the Second Council. And Mahayana splits off Theravada, or the Orthodox teaching. And Mahayana basically challenged two elements of Theravada Buddhism. And the first challenge was the role of the laity. And does anybody remember what the role really was of the laity under Theravada? Or this? Exactly. That's all the whole role of the laity was to support the temple, take care of it, clean it, monetarily, things like that, and then take care of the monks, their physical needs, all that kind of stuff. And then by doing that, they were hopefully building up a good karma, or burning off bad karma, however you want to look at it, so that the next time maybe they could come back as monks. So under Theravada, the only way of salvation possible was through becoming a monk, because then you could give yourself over to a life of, you know, monasticism, meditation, things like that, and then eventually enter Nirvana.
Is that karma? Is that exclusive to Buddhists or to other Eastern religions?
No, there a lot of different Eastern religions have it. Hinduism especially. Hinduism calls it karma as well. They have some different slants and different shades of meaning when it comes to karma, but they basically, karma is what you are accumulating while you're here on earth. And mostly what they're going to teach is it's going to depend, your karma now is going to depend on how you come back in a future life. Some will teach it does have an effect now as well, but mainly it's how you're going to be reincarnated the next time. Buddhism, especially Mahayana, was really starting to emerge and starting to be defined and things like that about the same time that the New Testament was being written. Buddhism
independently? Is there influence other than what I would think would be demons?
Well, I think the next week we're going to talk specifically about ethics in Buddhism and where ethics in Buddhism came from, which it was borrowed from a concept that was already prevalent in the Indian subcontinent. It's called Asima. And it was in Hinduism. It's also in Jainism and some of these other offshoot religions. But the concept of ethics, especially in Hinduism, is more a concept of, not nonviolence, but it's more a negative thing, where I'm not going to do anything to harm you, or this is where vegetarianism and things like that comes in. I'm not going to harm another animal. I'm not going to do things. But especially in Hinduism, ethics doesn't play as much of a positive role because they feel if you're an indigent, suffering out on the street, you're suffering that because of your karma. So if I go and help you, well, now you're not burning off enough of your karma, so you're going to come back and I'm really going to make it worse for you. So there's real no basis for real ethics under Hinduism. But like you say, as Buddhism comes in and they start seeing, and especially Mahayana, where they see some of the doctrines of grace and things like that I think are being preached around that area, yeah, we're going to see grace starting to come in and different kind of concepts of grace come in, and we're going to see some of that even tonight. And then next week when we look specifically at the ethics of Buddhism and where it came from and some of the developments, yeah, there's I think Christianity definitely had an influence on what they were teaching. Because there were some drastic changes in the way that they teach how you can, burn off your karma or reach salvation. Originally in Theravada and in Hinduism, there would have been no way possible for somebody else to help you. I mean, that you're on your own. And as you see developments in Buddhism, you're going to see where they come up with these concepts of the bodhisattva and these different things where they can actually help you, down your journey down the Eightfold Path. I think, yeah, that Christianity had an effect on what was going on there. So, like I was saying, Mahayana challenges two of the central elements of Theravada. The first was the role of the laity. And this was kind of what you're talking about there. They saw that the way of the monks, the way of monasticism and all that was way too narrow. It was way too monk-centered. It was kind of a selfish thing that it showed no compassion for the laity. It showed no compassion for the beggars on the street, things like that. So they opened it up more that salvation was available now to the laity. It was possible now to help, show compassion. And if you listen to the Dalai Lama, different Buddhists today, that's really the driving force behind what they teach is compassion, and that's peace, things like that. And Mahayana, because it wasn't monk and temple centered, that's I think one of the reasons that it is the largest representation of Buddhism today, because it wasn't centered in the temple. And if you remember a few lessons ago when we were talking about the major way that it spread across India, into China, into Japan, especially was through this King Asoka, who through military conquest, he went through, he conquered all that portion, the Indian subcontinent, that whole area. And then after he got done, he looks around, he sees all the suffering, all the misery that not only he caused, but that just people were going through. And so he somehow, I don't remember the whole story, but somehow he converted to Buddhism. And then it was his desire to spread this Dharma through Mahayana. And the Mahayanists are the ones that took up the cause to spread Buddhism all the way, like I say, to China, Japan, things like that. And this doctrine of Asima, or nonviolence, is one of the things that he wanted to spread across the continent was so Mahayana opened the way to salvation to the laity, and then also it introduced the concept of what we were talking about a minute ago was of the bodhisattva, which are these people who have they went down the Eightfold Path, they've gotten to the point where they can actually realize Buddhahood or enter into nirvana, but they refuse to do that. They say, no, I'm not gonna, you know, go into nirvana or take my salvation, but I'm gonna remain here so I can help other people on their, you know, trek down the Eightfold Path. So basically what they've done is they've went down the Eightfold Path through maybe thousands and thousands of incarnations, got rid of their karmic debt, so now they can come back and help you with some of yours. Which is definitely a concept that would have been totally abhorrent to Theravada. No way could you go and help somebody else. So the first challenge the Mahayanas had for Theravada was the role of the laity. And the second challenge was concerning the nature of Buddha himself. And in Mahayana, or in Theravada, there was one Buddha, the one historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. And then in Mahayana, they come up with the doctrine of what was known as the three bodies. And the first was the historical body, which would have been Siddhartha Gautama. Then there was the heavenly body, which would be these bodhisattvas that are in the heavenlies, waiting for either you to die so you can come up there, you can meet with them, they can help you so that when you're reincarnated, you can speed up your process of your journey down the Eightfold Path. And then there was the third body, was what was known as the body of essence, or the body of ultimate reality. And that's would be similar to the Hindus' view of Brahman. Our ultimate reality, obviously, is God, the Creator. So theirs is this body of essence, this Buddha of essence. And excuse me. So we had the split from Theravada, and you've got Mahayana and Theravada now. And then within Mahayana, there's going to be another split. And it's basically going to be over what is ultimate reality. What's the nature of this Dharmakaya? What's the nature of this body of essence? So what's going to happen is there within Mahayana, these different teachings are going to say there were two more turnings of this wheel of Dharma, this wheel of teaching. And the one view is held by the Madhyamaka, and their view of ultimate reality, and we're going to talk about this a little bit in a minute, is that reality is simply emptiness. It is. Not only exciting, but... Well, and that's the thing that if when people investigate and look, and they must not, they look into these kinds of things, there is no real personal hope where you maintain your identity in any of this Eastern philosophy.
If they die, they would know they have.
What's that?
If they die, they wouldn't know they have.
No, not really.
No,
but it doesn't matter because you're not real anyway. So the Madhyamaka's view of reality is emptiness, and then the Yogacara's view is a transcended consciousness. So there is some kind of a consciousness there, but your consciousness eventually is just going to kind of blend in with the universal consciousness. So you're still losing your personality. You're still losing your identity. There is a consciousness there, but are you still aware of it personally? No, it doesn't seem like it. You just kind of blend in with this cosmic consciousness, a transcended stream of consciousness. So in Buddhism today, there are a lot of different schools. Most of them are kind of region-specific, like Zen Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, these different things that are across Asia and Europe and things like that. There really isn't very much at all in India anymore. Again, Timothy Tennant says in his book, Christianity at the Religious Roundtable, he says, these systems of thought, Madhyamaka and Yogacara, ultimately must provide the philosophical framework for invocational forms of Buddhism, such as Pure Land, as well as popular meditative forms, such as Zen. And invocational just means to invoke the aid or the help of somebody else. And what he's saying there is, you have these different schools, but basically this Madhyamaka and Yogacara, the philosophies that they came up with, are going to, even though they don't call themselves that, and these terms are really not very important to remember, because the average Buddhist that you're going to meet, especially here in the West, probably has never heard of these terms. The philosophies he's going to understand to a point, but I work with a Buddhist, and my first conversation with him, I asked him, you know, what kind of a Buddhist are you? And he looked at me like I was from another planet. He's like, there's only one. I'm like, oh really, you should come to my class. But they don't. They don't have any concept. They don't really, you know, it's like Christians. You ask them, you know, a lot of them have no idea about different denominations and different things. And it's kind of the same thing here, only way worse. You know, and they don't. So these terms are, the philosophies are going to kind of infiltrate into the different teachings, but there's going to be a lot of overlap. There's going to be a lot of borrowing from all the different things, and it really turns into kind of a mishmash.
Was he
born into that? Was he converted into it? No, he's from, I believe, Vietnam. So he was born into it. And it's the same way with a lot of Christians. I mean, there are Christians that would never, they'll call themselves Christian, but they may never have even went to church. They have no idea what they really believe. I think, and we'll talk about this next week a little bit too. The bottom line is, with almost anybody like that, you just can't get very far away from the cross, because as we're going to see in these developments, even in Buddhism, it starts out with this real rigid, you can only be a monk. It maybe take thousands of incarnations before you can reach nirvana. Once you get there, you just kind of merge into this cosmic consciousness. Well, that's not very much hope. It's nothing to rest in. And they want something to rest in. So the more you just talk about the cross and talk about our hope, it does at least spark their interest. I'm not saying they're going to convert or anything like that, but even as we see these developments in Buddhism, they knew from the start that this isn't enough. This doesn't work. And what we'll talk about here in a minute is, even their own teachers saw that, you know what, this isn't working for people. So I think even our doctrine back then was kind of seeping in. So I think the main thing in any religion, you just don't get very far away from the cross, because it's the answer. So, these two major schools within Mahayana, and then the sutras or the texts, the scriptures that they use, are what's going to provide a lot of the teaching, a lot of the philosophy, a lot of the thought for popular Buddhism today. And the Madhyamaka school is represented by Tibetan Buddhism, or the Dalai Lama. And if you listen to a lot of the things he says, he talks a lot about, he's big nonviolence, you know, vegetarianism, things like that. A lot of the things, there's a doctrine called dependent arising, which is basically just reincarnation. There's no creator, there's no first cause of anything. Everything that comes along just was caused by something before it. Things like that. Those are the kinds of things that the Dalai Lama teaches. But he would be basically from the Madhyamaka school. And then from the Yogacara school, you're going to find Buddhism in China, Japan. Zen Buddhism is from the Yogacara school. But there again, you just have a lot of overlap. You might listen to the Dalai Lama. He'll talk about some things from the Madhyamaka school, but he's also going to bring a lot of stuff over from Yogacara. It really just turns into a big kind of mishmash of doctrine. There's no...
Is he considered teaching the pinnacle, the quintessence of what they're teaching
is,
or are there others?
I would say today he's definitely the most famous. He's the most well-known around the world.
Would he proclaim to have a
No.
The people don't think he's a Buddha.
If you asked him if he was a Buddha, he wouldn't tell you that he was, no. What's that? Well, I don't know if he said he was, if he couldn't be, but not only is he Buddha, you're Buddha. You have that same thing inside of you. But I don't think if you asked him, I don't think he would say, yes, I'm Buddha. I'm a Buddha, even.
Could an uninitiated, an outsider, could he come into a Buddhist temple? Or would he be welcome? What would he do? Would he say, I want to convert? Suppose I walked into a Buddhist temple. Would I be looking for fathers? What are you doing here? How would they handle things like that?
I really don't know. And it's one of the things I intended to do before I started the class, and I haven't done it yet, but I do want to go to this temple with this friend of mine and just see exactly what do you do. I know there's a lot of chanting, a lot of meditation, a lot of, you know, incense burning, a lot of sitting before the statue of the Buddha, things like that. But does somebody stand up and do a sermon? Think, no, I don't think it's anything. I don't think it's anything like that. And there's one over by Holland too that I'm going to stop at. Just see if you can talk to them. See what exactly do you do when you go to temple. But I think you would be welcome. You might get some strange looks, but. I don't think a Buddhist would look at conversion the way we do. Because like I say, you can remain in your Christianity and still be a Buddhist. You would just try to follow the path in your own way, through meditation, through reading their different scriptures, things like that. But you're going to have to find your own Dharma and your own way of following the Eightfold Path. And you could do that through the Bible. Just don't try to say that, you know, that's the only way. But I don't think there would really be any concept of real conversion, the way we would look at conversion, like you're going to leave Buddhism and become a Christian. It's like you can remain in your Christianity and follow Buddhist practice as well.
Remember the
Beatles?
Sure.
Well, everybody but Ringo, at least. I think he left fairly early because he didn't want to quit eating meat. But, and then the yogi that they were teaching under found out that they were trying to take shortcuts and using drugs, and I think he ended up kind of not having anything to do with them. But there's definitely a lot of Buddhist and Eastern thought in some of the Beatles' music, for sure. And a lot of that stuff you're listening to when you're a 16, 17-year-old kid, and you're going, what are they talking about? But now when you look back, and there's one song called I Am the Eggman, and it goes, I am you, as you are him, as you are as he, as we are all together. Well, what is he talking about? I'm you, you're me, I'm him. It's that whole Eastern philosophy of monism. You know, we're all just one. And when you're a kid listening to stuff like that, it just sounds cool, I guess. You know, especially probably some of the things we were doing when we were listening to the Beatles. That's not funny, dude. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when the Dalai Lama dies, supposedly there's already one that's born that's a reincarnation of the one that just died. So this group of monks sets off on this quest across Asia to look for the next Dalai Lama. And what they'll have is they'll have a whole bunch of artifacts or articles that belonged to the previous Dalai Lama. And they'll have some other things mixed in there. And this baby supposedly picks out the things that were the... This is one way that they tell. Picks out the things that belonged to the deceased Dalai Lama. And that's how they kind of pick the next one in succession.
That's got to be, if there's anything that would appeal to me or to man who's really in a vacuum and wants some meaning to his life. If I can't make it here, I can maybe make it in the next one. So, that seems to be the basis of
From our viewpoint, that would probably sound good because, yeah, you can reincarnate into another life, hopefully better, but maybe a lot worse. You know, you could come back as a, you know, a street person or an insect, or as Dave. So their real goal is to get off that wheel of, because they see. They see the entire wheel of samsara, this entire wheel of reincarnation, as a wheel of suffering. Life on earth is made up of suffering and misery, and you're going to come back and just do that all over and over again. So their ultimate goal is this nirvana, or just that entering into the cosmic consciousness, the blowing out of the candle, you know. Right? There is no hope the way we have hope. There's no doubt about it. They see getting off that wheel as the hope, that the reincarnation ends.
Will your friend listen to the gospel?
Yeah, he listens, sure. But he just sees it as another tree in a big forest.
You're very excited about the hope of heaven. Seems very important.
At this point, I can't really... There's something weird going on here. At this point, I don't think, you know, he doesn't really get excited about it, but yeah, he listens. And I work with him, so I get to talk to him quite often. So it's just kind of a process, you know, see that what we have is definitely better. Now, where were we? Okay, so the first turning is of the wheel is this Theravada, and it's just the original teachings of the Buddha. The second wheel is rises within Mahayana, and that's these secret teachings, these additional teachings that the Buddha revealed to his initiates, to his intimate disciples. And here, like I was saying before, this is where the whole canon of Buddhism now is blown wide open. It goes way beyond this Tripitaka, this three baskets, these original writings. And that is why there's no fixed scripture. There's no final authority. And you can't really nail them down as to what exactly they believe because there's no final authority to appeal to. There are thousands of different scriptures that they go to read. And not only that, every person's journey is within. You all have to go down your own path, find your own way, complete your own, you know, dharma down this path, this eightfold path. So, the second turning is within then the Mahayana context, and it is called the Madhyamaka school of Buddhism. And they call themselves the Middle Way School because they view themselves as ultimate reality is not non-existent and it's not existence. It's the middle way between non-existence and existence. And they just call it emptiness. It was founded in the 2nd century AD by Nagarjuna, and some people refer to him as actually the second Buddha. It's founded on a body of writings that was either written by, there's a lot of myth, there's a lot of stories in Buddhism, but it's written, it's founded on a body of writings that was either written by or expounded by this Nagarjuna. And that body of writings is known as the Perfection Sutras or the Perfection Texts. And within this body of writing, there are a number of different ones, but they include some of the more well-known ones are the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, and the Heart Sutra. And Nagarjuna claimed that these texts, these scriptures, were the actual teaching of Buddha, but were only made known to him and through these or through these more intimate disciples.
So a sutra is
text. It's a text, a scripture. Yeah. So the main point and the main difference between Madhyamaka and Yogacara is the view that they take of this ultimate reality or this body of essence. And like I said, in Madhyamaka, the ultimate reality is seen as emptiness. And one must come to the realization that all reality is that which passes away. All is emptiness. Reality is found in no permanence. And, yeah. So what I want to do, I want to read a passage out of, it's called the Buddhist Bible. And it's just an edited edition that somebody in the West here did of putting together a whole bunch of different Buddhist texts. It's not, Bible just means book, so it's a Buddhist book. I can't really explain this emptiness. They will even tell you that emptiness is not something that can be explained with language. It must be something that is just experienced or just, you just get it. So they'll write books, texts, thousands of pages in words to try to explain to you something that can't be explained in words. So I'm just going to read a little bit out of here on their explanation of what their view of this emptiness is. And what this is Buddha is sitting around with some of his disciples and they're asking him questions and things like that. So, and I'm going to skip the names because I'm just going to skip the names. These make Old Testament names look easy. So if a son or a daughter wishes to study the profound Prajna Paramita, which is just these perfection sutras, that's what that means, how is he to do so? If a son, and the teacher says, if a son or a daughter wishes to study the perfection sutras, he must first get rid of all ideas of ego and selfness. Let him think thus, personality. What is personality? Is it an enduring entity? Or is it made up of the elements that pass away? So right there they're telling you, you don't really have an enduring personality. So don't even think about keeping it once you reach salvation, because you don't really have a you that is you. Personality is made up of the five grasping aggregates, just known as the five aggregates. They are form, sensation, perception, discrimination, and consciousness, all of which are by nature empty of any self-substance. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. Neither is form different from emptiness. Indeed, emptiness is form. And then they just go through the all five and say basically the same thing. So it boils down to perception is just emptiness. Discrimination, consciousness, it's just emptiness. So all five of these aggregates are what make up you, the you that is you. But it's something that's just going to pass away. You basically are just emptiness. Thus, all things having the nature of emptiness, having no beginning and no ending, they are neither faultless nor not faultless. They are neither perfect nor imperfect. In emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no discrimination, no consciousness. Why is there no obtaining of nirvana? Because nirvana is the realm of no thingness. If the ego or the soul of personality was an enduring entity, it could not obtain nirvana. It is only because personality is made up of the elements that pass away that personality may attain nirvana. So basically what they're telling you is the only reason that you can attain nirvana is because the part of you that attains nirvana is going to pass away. It's just emptiness. The great passing, the great emptiness is the passing away. I just made that up.
If emptiness is passing away, but emptiness is not, how can nothing pass away?
And that's why this is so hard, because coming from a perspective like we come from, it really is no true, real understanding of this. You just
sounds like escaping this hard. Well, in your plane ride through it, it's important because culturally, raised in a Christian culture, which there's absolute, there's distance, not existence. I mean, we understand things very differently. When somebody's out of culture, for Buddhism is the culture, they grow up with a different way of thinking about things. You know, even if they're not necessarily, you know, real Buddhist or not. But anyway, I'm just saying that their whole view of it is much different. It's hard for us to come at it from our perspective and see.
Well, it definitely does, because even, I don't know if you've seen some of the logic textbooks and things like that, you'll see the law of non-contradiction, you know, A is not non-A, or A is not B, you know, things like that. Well, they'll say things like A is A, A is non-A. And they'll have their own logic tables, but there's nothing logical about them because they totally contradict themselves. But they think because they can write it down in that kind of a thing that they have proven that Buddha's teachings of, say, the law of dependent arising, which there is no first cause and all this kind of stuff, that everything is caused, you know, from something before it, which is this whole wheel of... What's that?
Which is a cause.
Right, but then... Exactly, and not only that, but there is no first cause. It's just an eternal arising, just an eternal wheel of this samsara, of this reincarnation. And the only thing that's going to eventually stop it is when everything comes to this realization that nirvana is samsara, that all is one, that your consciousness is just this melding into the universal consciousness. Yeah, the evolutionists have a big problem with science proving that the universe has a beginning. They really have no idea what to do with that. They don't have an answer to it. I think what the evolutionists do, some of the things they try to tell people are so stupid that I think I can't believe that they even really believe it, but because the public is so gullible, they don't study for themselves, they don't look into the true doctrines of creation and where things really came from and things like that. They just throw these things out there waiting. I think they truly believe that theism is wrong. I think they truly believe that science is right, and I think they truly believe if we just throw up this smoke screen long enough, science is going to come up with the answer. Because some of the things that they say is just... have any of you ever seen the movie Expelled with Ben Stein?
Oh, yeah. Great.
Some of the things those guys say, they can't believe it.
Dawkins? Oh, Ben Stein had a talk. I mean, he was so upset, so confused, he was sputtering, and finally said he thought that they all came from outer space.
Right, yeah, they'll believe something like that. Or the one guy there, I can't remember his name, he had the scruffy gray hair with the beard and mustache and things like that. And Ben asked him where everything came from, and he says, well, I think these first things, the first life piggybacked on the back of crystals. And Ben Stein's like trying to get him, where did these come from? And he's like, I just told you. Well, where did the crystals come from? See, they don't have any idea what was the first cause.
Some theories about the beginning are that there was a wrinkle in nothingness. That's what they say, literally. Wrinkle in nothingness, and that's how the first matter appears and then evolves there.
And this latest book that came out by Stephen Hawking, that's kind of the concept that he has, that this everything... And I don't know all the terminology, but yeah, it just sprang out of nothingness. But people that say that don't really understand nothing. I mean, they really don't. You can say, there's nothing in the air here, but there's dust. There is something here. Nothing in nothing before God created something is nothing. And nothing, you know, you can... I told a guy at work one time, he's an atheist. I said, if you think life is just going to spring from nothing or from whatever, this primordial swamp or whatever, I'll even give you more than nothing. I'll give you dirt. You know, just lay it, see if something springs out of it, you know. But these atheists, they really just don't understand nothing. I don't know how we got on that.
Is that actually very similar to the thinking of Buddhism, really, in trying to explain things?
Right, the eternal turning of the wheel.
Right. I mean, it started from nothing, there was no first cause, and then there's just this kind of evolution that supposedly is getting things better and better and better to ill-defined state of perfection.
See, and that's where their culture would. They would never even think of a first cause. It's just always been here. It's just always been evolving, you know. Evolving to emptiness. Or into a transcended stream of consciousness, which is what the next view believes. So those were the first two turnings. There was the original one, the original turning in Theravada. And the second turning was this Madhyamaka, and their view of ultimate reality was this emptiness. And then the third turning is what's called Yogacara. That developed around the 4th century. There are a lot of different traditions about who originally started Yogacara. But their view of the essence or the Dharmakaya is that ultimate reality is consciousness. And it's a consciousness that you have to realize that's above your consciousness. It's something that you just have to enter into. The practice of yoga was developed to as an aid to teach people how to transcend their own consciousness so that they could become a part of this cosmic consciousness. They teach that the physical world is just illusion, and that by entering these other states of consciousness, you can transcend this world of illusion. I'm going to skip a little bit here. It's already 7 o'clock. But what I'll do is, I want to just illustrate this thought about consciousness, or in your mind, projecting or creating reality through a story about how Pure Land Buddhism came to be. Pure Land Buddhism is a Japanese Buddhism. It was started by a follower of Buddha named Amida. And in Pure Land Buddhism, there is a representation of the Dharmakaya known as Dhyana Buddha. And Dhyana means wisdom, and supposedly there are 5 of these wisdom Buddhas, and Amida is one of them. According to Japanese Buddhist mythology, while Amida was passing through his incarnations, he was overwhelmed with the suffering and the misery of humanity. He noted that very few people could actually ever attain nirvana. So Amida vowed to provide a way for all human beings to reach salvation. So once he became a Buddha, Amida, with pure mental powers, created a paradise in the western regions of heaven known as the Pure Land. So this is what I was mentioned before about this invocational form of Buddhism. Amida creates this what he calls the Pure Land, and he just does it through pure mental powers. And in Pure Land Buddhism, no demands are placed on the followers other than to show thankfulness to Amida through chanting, meditation, and adoration. The chant Namu Amida Butsu, or Hail to Amida Buddha, is chanted over and over, and most in the Pure Land tradition teach that this is just a chant of thanksgiving for what Amida has already accomplished, while others insist it is necessary to enter the Pure Land. So here I think we really see the concept of grace and somebody else doing something for you, entering into Buddhist thought. And by this time, Christianity is definitely being spread throughout this part of the world. So I could definitely see where the doctrines of grace and some of the things that were being taught by them would have crept over into Buddhist thought. So as we said before, the main area of discussion and difference between the schools within Mahayana is the concept of ultimate reality or the body of essence. In Madhyamaka, ultimate reality is emptiness or non-permanence. And in Yogacara, ultimate reality is a transcendent stream of consciousness, a merging of your consciousness with the transcendent ultimate consciousness. And again, in both forms, your personality is ultimately lost. You lose who you are, you lose the you that is you, you lose your identity. So, any form of Buddhism, Hinduism, these Eastern religions, there really is no hope the way we have hope in Christ. Next week, what I want to do is I'll look at Buddhist. We'll look at Buddhist ethics. We'll look at where they came from, how they fit into the Buddhist concept of things, and then we'll compare that to our view of ethics, salvation, things like that. So, I think a couple of weeks ago, I said it would be good if you would read Romans 7 and 8, just kind of look at our view of what's going on today, why we have suffering in the world, things like that. And then next week we'll compare Buddhism with Christianity. Any other questions, comments?
You mentioned, of course, reincarnation. The Bible definitely.